When John Cade was born in a small town in Australia, his future professional field was also in its infancy, if indeed it had been truly born at all. At that time, Melbourne had institutions to keep large lunatic asylums. But rather than providing treatment, these institutions mainly served as places to house those patients, since effective therapies for mental illnesses didn't exist at the time. But living many of his younger years within the grounds of these institutions was to have a major bearing on his later deep understanding of the needs of the mentally ill. This is the story of John Cade, the lithium pioneer. Greetings, amazing listeners. Welcome to the first episode of the RX Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Radin Alekhani, and this episode is being released in March 2025. In each episode of the RX Chronicles podcast, I talk about the story behind the discovery of a pharmaceutical breakthrough and familiarize you with the biography of their founders, from challenges in their life to the pushing force toward their invention and more, to hopefully acknowledge and enlighten their names in the pharmaceutical galaxy. In this episode, I'll talk about the serendipitous history of lithium and introduce John Cade, the mastermind of using lithium in treating mentally ill patients for the first time. So, without further ado, the RX Chronicles podcast, episode 1, The Mood Metal, John Cade. The history of lithium is a little bit like that of the man who ate the first oyster. Lithium belongs to a class of metals known as alkali metals. Lithium was discovered from a mineral, while other common alkali metals were discovered from plant material. This probably explains the origin of the element's name from lithos, which is the Greek word for stone. Lithium is soft, silvery, and has the lowest density of all metals. Lithium has been in medical use, including psychiatry, for many years. Many mineral springs contain lithium, among other elements, and some of them, such as mineral wells in Texas, have age-old reputations as crazy waters. In 1847, London internist Alfred Baring Garrett discovered uric acid in the blood of gouty patients. Garrett made the lithium treatment of gout widely known in his 1859 work, The Nature and Treatment of Gout and Rheumatic Gout. By the 1930s, a number of lithium-containing products were on the market, mostly indicated for the control of renal calculi and the uric acid diathesis. For example, in 1939, the German pharmaceutical index, the Red List, featured lithosanol Bauer, a combination product of lithium citrate and several other components for kidney, bladder, and gallstones. In an early psychiatric reference to lithium in 1870, Philadelphia neurologist Silas Weir Mitchell recommended lithium bromide as an anticonvulsant and a hypnotic. Mitchell later came out for the bromides, preferably lithium bromide, for general nervousness. In 1871, William Hammond, professor of diseases of the mind and nervous system at the Bellevue Hospital Medical College in New York, became the first physician to prescribe lithium for mania. It was, however, Denmark that became the flagship land in using lithium for the treatment and prophylaxis of depression. In 1894, Danish psychiatrist Frederik Lange made explicit reference to lithium in the treatment of melancholic depression, ultimately treating 35 patients with lithium carbonate. But the modern revival of lithium began in 1949 in the Bundoora Repatriation Hospital, which was a veterans hospital in a suburb of Melbourne, Australia, when John Cade, the hero of this episode, aware of Garrett's success in using lithium a century previously in the treatment of gout, hypothesized that some condition involving uric acid might lie behind his manic patient's psychotic excitement. John Frederick Joseph Cade A.O. was born on January 18, 1912, in the small town of Murtowa in the state of Victoria in Australia. He is the son of David Cade, a medical practitioner, and Ellen Edwards Cade. John was still a small boy when his father left for World War I for Gallipoli and later France to serve in the 3rd Field Ambulance. John's father returned in 1919 as a colonel with a Distinguished Service Order, but with severe physical and mental exhaustion, referred to at the time as war weariness. After the war, his war-weary father became increasingly exhausted from treating a large number of his patients in the influenza pandemic of the time. Therefore, he sold his general practice in Murtowa and gratefully accepted a position with the mental hygiene department, where he worked in 3 of the major mental hospitals over the next 25 years. Given his father's career, John spent part of his childhood in mental hospitals and with mental disorders. Hence, his deep empathy with patients throughout his career can be fully understood. When it was time to choose a secondary school, rather than following his father's tradition at Melbourne Grammar School, John chose Scotch College. He received his first class honor certificate in 1926 and matriculated in 1928 at the age of 16. After matriculation, he entered the University of Melbourne School of Medicine in 1929 and graduated in 1934 when he was only 21 years old, with honors in all subjects. He served his internship at St. Vincent's Hospital, followed by a period at the Royal Children's Hospital and then at Royal Park Psychiatric Hospital. When his uncle, who was a general practitioner, died in 1931 and left the legacy to each of his 3 nephews, John used his to reimburse his father for his university fees. These were frugal times, as John was leaving away from his family during his education and stayed with his cousin in their old family home, paying 5 guineas per week for board. Guinea was an old British gold coin worth a pound, which at the time was the equivalent of 21 shillings. A while after, John became a house officer at St. Vincent's Hospital and later at the Royal Children's Hospital, where he developed bilateral pneumococcal pneumonia. He was fortunate to survive, and one of his special nurses during this illness was Astana Evelyn Jean Charles, whom he married in 1937. They were too poor to buy an engagement ring or to have guests at their wedding. Their 2 eldest boys, John and David, were born in 1938 and 1940, respectively. After marriage, John persuaded his new wife to move to Beechworth in the northeast of Victoria with only a few sticks of furniture to commence their married life. Jean recalled that while at Beechworth as a young medical officer, John was somewhat of a stirrer in that he noticed many patients with bruises and suspected the lack of vitamin C in their diet. Through a very persuasive paper to the director of mental hygiene of the time, he proceeded to advocate for these patients to improve their diet by the provision of fresh fruit and vegetables. Such was the strength of his advocacy that fresh fruit and vegetables became an essential part of the diet of patients in mental hospitals after the time. John's interest in research about mental disorders was frustrated by the onset of World War II. As a student, John retrained with Melbourne University Rifles. Within the few months of graduation, the young doctor went on to volunteer for the Australian Army Medical Corps. In order to uphold the family tradition, he joined the newly formed 9th Field Ambulance. In 1940, he was commissioned captain and was subsequently promoted to major, officer commanding headquarters company, and adjunct of the unit. Like his father a generation earlier, John left his wife and small boys to serve in an overseas field ambulance in a global military conflict. He sailed from Australia in 1941 and returned 4 years later. Initially, he wrote to his family from Malaya, which today is part of Malaysia and Singapore, but the Japanese advance and the fall of Singapore was happening so fast. At the fall of Singapore, John and his men became prisoners of war in Changi in Singapore. He was interned for more than 3 years in the notorious Japanese prisoner of war camp at Changi. He was put in charge of the psychiatric section, where he began to note the decisive link between certain food deficiencies and diseases in his fellow prisoners. A lack of B vitamins, for instance, caused beriberi and pellagra. They were the first to enter the prisoners of war camp and to set up a 270-bed hospital for the reception of the sick and wounded who were being marched in. He was often referred to as the Mad Major because of his interest and background in psychiatry. It has also been reported that John had a remarkable memory. During their imprisonment in Changi, his task was to listen to the nightly BBC broadcast on the hidden radio, and when it was too dangerous to carry written reports, he committed the entire news to memory and repeated it verbatim to his audience of fellow prisoners of war. His memorized recitals of the forbidden BBC news are well remembered by his men, who still remark on the manner of his delivery as if he were in front of the BBC microphone. He took considerable risks in secretly obtaining copies of BBC news transcripts, committing these to memory, and then relaying them to his men. He felt a strong sense of obligation to the local population who risked their lives to provide medicine and food to the prisoners of war. After the war, in August 1945, he put forward the idea of establishing the Australian Imperial Forces, or AIF, Malaysian Nursing Scholarships Scheme as his way of repaying the local population who supported the Australian prisoners of war. On his return from the war, he was about only 40 kilograms and typical of so many surviving post-war prisoners. After the war, John returned to medical practice at Bundoora Repatriation Mental Hospital to his beloved ex-diggers, where he sought to care for their physical and spiritual as well as medical and psychiatric well-being. It was here that his post-war children were born. In 1947, Mary, 1948, Peter, and 1950, Richard. Mary died when she was only 1 day old due to an obstetric complication, and this was perhaps his life's greatest tragedy, with lasting memories of carrying the tiny coffin in his hands at her small funeral. It was during this period that he experimented with lithium in the treatment of manic excitement and in 1949 published his seminal paper. Family memories of this event are of guinea pigs laying contentedly on their backs in an empty ward pharmacy, of manic urine in the fridge, of his own ingestion of lithium to his wife's dismay, and of the grubby little man who was the first to be cured of his mania by lithium. After the war, John pursued his investigations, working from an abandoned pantry in Bandura Repatriation Mental Hospital. He began to collect urine samples from people with depression, mania, and schizophrenia, aiming to discover whether some secretion in their urine could be correlated to their symptoms. With no access to sophisticated chemical analysis and largely unguided by theory, John injected the urine into the abdominal cavities of guinea pigs, raising the dose until they died. The urine of people with mania proved especially lethal to the animals. In further experiments at Bandura, John found that lithium carbonate, which had been used to treat conditions such as gout since the 19th century, reduced the toxicity of patients' urine. John also noticed that a large dose of the medication tended to calm the guinea pigs. He could turn them on their backs, and the normally restive rodents could gaze placidly back at him. He wondered whether lithium could have the same tranquilizing effect on his patients. After trying it out on himself to establish a safe dose, John began treating 10 people with mania. In September 1949, he reported fast and dramatic improvements in all of his patients in the Medical Journal of Australia. The majority of these 10 patients had been in and out of Bandura for years. Now, 5 had improved enough to return to their homes and families. As I mentioned, John Cade began treating 10 manic patients with lithium citrate and lithium carbonate. Some responded remarkably well, becoming essentially normal and capable of discharge after years of illness. But unfortunately, 1949 was precisely the wrong time for such an article to appear. After a recent failed experiment with lithium chloride as a substitute for sodium chloride in patients with congestive heart failure, and moreover, in such a then obscure journal. John's discovery was significant not just because it added an important new agent to the psychopharmacologic armamentarium, but because it illustrated the triumph of the scientific method at a time when psychiatry was in danger of losing sight of science. As John's son, Jack, who himself was an intensive care specialist in Melbourne, and Sydney psychiatry professor, Jean Malley, noted in 2007, John Cade's discovery demonstrates the importance of clinical observation, the significance of reporting case findings, the value of being patient-centered, and the scientific benefit of an open and inquiring mind. John's article did not go entirely unnoticed, prompting isolated studies of lithium. For example, in Melbourne in 1951, Nowak and Trautner found in an open trial of over 100 patients that the therapeutic benefits outweighed the side effects, judging lithium very beneficial for mania. In France, in the same year, 2 physicians at the St. Albain Mental Hospital administered lithium citrate to 10 patients with chronic mania, concluding the use of lithium in the manic phases of manic depressive psychoses seems particularly effective. Yet, the echo was faint. The breakthrough in lithium treatment for mania and the prophylaxis of manic depressive illness began in 1952 when Erik Stromgren, the head of the Aarhus University Psychiatric Clinic in Riskov, Denmark, who had read John's article, suggested to his staff psychiatrist at the hospital, Mogens Skau, that he might undertake a randomly controlled trial of lithium in mania. Random controls were just being introduced in psychiatric drug trials in those years. Mogens Skau knew the condition intimately because his brother had it. Skau randomized the mania patients with a flip of a coin to lithium or placebo, and in 1954, he published the results in a British journal. Scow concluded, the lithium therapy appears to offer a useful alternative to electroconvulsive therapy, or simply ECT, since many patients can be kept in a normal state by administration of a maintenance dose. The Scow article had a large impact and awakened the possibility of lithium treatment for an illness that previously had been governed mainly by barbiturates, which had been the most widely used agents in treating manic patients during the first half of the 20th century and until the mid-1950s. Through the 1960s and 1970s, Scow teamed up with fellow psychiatrist Paul Bustrup to conduct a series of lithium experiments with ever stricter conditions, culminating in a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial. They published several papers together, and their findings established beyond doubt that lithium was effective for most people with bipolar disorder, including Scow's brother. Yet lithium was tricky to administer and blood vessels a matter of guesswork. The introduction of the Coleman flame photometer in 1958 changed the situation, making it possible to ascertain more precisely than with the old Beckman photometer how much lithium a patient actually had on board. This opened the way for lithium's widespread therapeutic use in clinical medicine. In the international history of lithium, the United States was more or less the last in, first out, in the sense that the United States is one of the few countries, perhaps the only one, where other drugs such as valproate or antidepressants are given to bipolar patients much more often than lithium. At a time when lithium was firmly established elsewhere, in the United States, interest in lithium only began to build in the 1960s. The seminal event was probably Samuel Gershon's arrival in 1960 at the Schizophrenia and Psychopharmacology Joint Research Project of the University of Michigan at the Mental Hospital in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Gershon, familiar with lithium from working with a group at the University of Melbourne, introduced lithium to the hospital. In a program financed by Jonathan Cole at the National Institute of Mental Health, or NIMH, and directed by Ralph W. Gerard, the investigators at Ypsilanti brought lithium by a kilo from a chemical supply store, then had the local pharmacy put it into capsules. In 1960, Gershon and Arthur U. Weiler, also at Ypsilanti, brought out the first North American publication on lithium. It was evidently Gershon's Michigan experiences that caused the Rawal Laboratories in Minnesota to acquire an early interest in commercializing lithium. In 1963, Gershon moved to the University of Missouri in St. Louis, then to New York Medical School, where he became prominent among American investigators of lithium. In 1962, George Winokur introduced lithium to Washington University in St. Louis, having the Barnes Hospital Pharmacy make up the pills and achieving an amazing remission in a patient who had failed on chlorpromazine treatment and 18 sessions of ECT. After that experience, lithium was the mainstay in the treatment of mania at Barnes Hospital. By the late 1960s, a kind of lithium underground had formed in the United States, many physicians prescribing it without bothering to seek investigational new drug applications or INDs from the FDA. Meanwhile, lithium had long become registered elsewhere. For example, lithium carbonate in 1966 in the United Kingdom, lithium acetate in 1967 in Germany, and lithium glutamate in 1970 in Italy. When later in 1970, the FDA did approve lithium, the United States became the 50th country to do so. At the FDA, it was Merrill Gibson, director of the neuropharmacology division, who finally overcame internal agency apprehensions and pushed for approval of lithium for acute mania. It is possible that this decision was also motivated by Dr. Paul Blatchy's public declaration from the University of Oregon Medical School's Department of Psychiatry that he would prescribe lithium even without FDA approval. With the exception of electroconvulsive therapy, lithium is the single most effective treatment in psychiatry. Its side effects are easily manageable, and many patients stay on low-dose lithium for decades. Its benefits, in terms of relief of mania and the prophylaxis of depression, are incalculable. Indeed, lithium's discovery, which set off the psychopharmacological revolution of the 1950s, with antipsychotics and antidepressants arriving in its wake, is in many ways a stunning success. Yet, it was developed in a ramshackle pantry, and the bottle urine samples were stored in the Cade family refrigerator. Moreover, in retrospect, the discovery of lithium seems in part related to an erroneous interpretation on Cade's part. The tranquilized guinea pigs were probably showing the first signs of lithium poisoning, lethargy, which is the feeling of low energy that can affect mental functions, is still a warning sign of an overdose. And the step from guinea pigs to humans was a conceptual leap as well. To be honest, it's unlikely that a modern researcher in 2025 would get permission for experiments such as Cade's. John Cade's findings could easily have foundered if Iskow and others hadn't followed up on his 1949 paper. Thus, hailing Cade as a trailblazer is valid, but without Iskow and the rest, there would be no trail. Thanks to them all, this ubiquitous element, easily manufactured and never patented by pharmaceutical companies, remains both cheap and invaluable as a treatment for a troubling disorder. Today, lithium helps to stabilize the moods of millions of people with the condition, although the dose must be carefully controlled and it can have unpleasant side effects such as nausea and trembling. The mechanism of action of lithium is still something of a mystery. However, most research targets the delicate chemistry supporting the functioning of neurotransmitters. For instance, lithium inhibits excitatory neurotransmitters such as dopamine and glutamate and promotes GABA-mediated neurotransmission. Lithium has also shown neuroprotective effects in a number of brain regions suggested by changes in the gray matter volume. Also, the exact cause of the disorder is still unknown. It's clear that there is a genetic component, though. If one of a pair of monozygotic twins who share all their genetic material has the disorder, there is around a 60% chance that the other will have it. In dizygotic twins, the figure is 10%. It might also be interesting to you that when 7-Up was originally placed on the market in 1929, it was named Bip Label Lithiated Lemon Lime Soda. A much less catchy, though more descriptive name. The lithiated in the name came from the soda's ingredient, lithium citrate. 7-Up used lithium citrate in its formula until 1948, when the US FDA outlawed the usage of chemicals in soda drinks. Just like other drugs, lithium is available in the market with different brand names. As such, for the liquid tablets include Pryodal, Kemcolit, and Lisconum. It also comes as a lithium citrate liquid that you swallow. Common brand names of lithium liquid are Pryodal and Li liquid. Lithium may be used to treat acute manic or mixed episodes in people with bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. You might ask here, what's the difference between bipolar 1 and 2? Simply saying, people with bipolar 1 disorder experience mania differently than those with bipolar 2 disorder. A person with bipolar 1 will experience an episode of mania, while a person with bipolar 2 will experience a hypomanic episode, which is a period less severe than a full manic episode. People with bipolar 1 disorder may also not have major depressive episodes, while all people with bipolar 2 disorder do. And lithium is considered the first-line agent for the initial treatment of depressive, manic, or mixed episodes in bipolar disorder. Lithium has also been used off-label for the treatment of depression in people who fail to respond to antidepressants. After digestion of the lithium formulation, it's completely absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract and reaching peak levels within 1/4 to 3 hours after oral administration of immediate release preparations and 2 to 6 hours after sustained release preparations. A reduce in manic symptoms should be noticed within 5 to 7 days, but the full therapeutic effect may require 10 to 21 days. That is why regular blood tests during treatment with lithium is necessary to ensure that the dosage is appropriate for patients. Dosing may be difficult because there is not much of a margin between an adequate dose of lithium and a toxic dose. In fact, there is a fine line between too much and too little lithium. Fine hand tremors, frequent urination, and mild thirst commonly occur during lithium initiation. Sometimes these effects may persist throughout treatment. It is recommended to seek urgent medical attention if symptoms similar to diabetes, such as excessive thirst or excessive urine production, occur. The other important point worth mentioning here is the lithium toxicity: diarrhea, vomiting, drowsiness, muscular weakness, loss of appetite, and coordination difficulties may be an early sign of lithium toxicity. Dizziness, blurred vision, ringing in the ears, and excessive production of dilute urine may occur with higher toxic lithium levels. Too much caffeine may decrease the amount of lithium in your body as well. Also, if you cut out salt from your diet, it can affect blood levels of lithium. Sodium in salt and lithium share several important similarities, which explains why changes in salt intake can affect lithium levels in your body. For example, sodium and lithium both are alkali metals with similar chemical properties. Both are viciously reactive with water, which is relevant to their behavior in aqueous bodily fluids. Lithium is reabsorbed in the kidneys at the same rate as sodium and water. Therefore, when salt intake is reduced, the body compensates by conserving sodium and lithium in the kidneys, potentially causing lithium levels to rise. That's why it is important to ensure adequately hydrated while taking lithium and maintain an adequate salt intake. Lastly, lithium may cause drowsiness or reduced alertness. Driving or operating machinery should be done with caution until its effects are known. Alcohol should be avoided while taking lithium as well. Thank you. Before we wrap up this episode, let's finish John Cade's story by highlighting some hallmarks of his personality and his final years of life. We ended up in Bundoora, where John found promising results after treating 10 manic patients from lithium. From Bundoora Repatriation Mental Hospital, he moved to Royal Park Hospital, where he became superintendent and influenced generations of psychiatrists through his teaching. Royal Park Hospital throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s was a mecca for aspiring psychiatrists in training who valued the placement at that institution very highly. In his role of superintendent of Royal Park Psychiatric Hospital, John Cade revealed much of his humanity and sensitivities. As a gently religious man, this is actually the way his wife, Jean, used to describe him, a gently religious man. As a gently religious man, he supported the employment of chaplains. He built a most comfortable chapel so that the spiritual needs of patients and staff would be provided for, which was a far cry from the harsh secularization of patient care in present mental health programs. A mark of his simplicity and modesty was that his extraordinary discovery was not fully appreciated by his own family, and indeed by many others, until overseas awards flowed some 20 or more years later. On one of these occasions, he was leaving to New York to receive the prestigious Kitay Award, which was at the time the world's most valuable prize in psychiatry, carrying no luggage other than his briefcase with little more than a toothbrush and a clean shirt. He was later to be invited to be a distinguished fellow of the American College of Psychiatrists, but he was especially proud to have been president of his own Australian college. He was also proud to have been one of the early recipients of the newly created Australian Awards, and he always liked to wear his small lapel badge of Officer of the Order of Australia, abbreviated as AO. Loyalty to his staff is a well-remembered characteristic of John Cade. He used to keep a small folded-up umbrella in the bottom drawer of his desk. He joked that it was to be open in the event that head office starting bucketing the staff at Royal Park. He always had morning and afternoon tea with the junior administrative staff and the artisans, as such, carpenters, plumbers, and engineering staff. He knew of their family lives, their joys, and vicissitudes, and was genuinely interested in them as friends as well as employees. He took pains to defend the staff against many head office thunders and lightnings. That the nomination for his Order of Australia Award was initiated by a member of the clerical staff speaks much of his loyalty and how much loyalty was returned by those who worked with him. In the area of equal opportunity for women, he was eons ahead of his time. He encouraged a female medical officer to bring her newborn infant to work to be looked after by the domestic staff when childcare could not be arranged. He had a flexible attitude towards working married women that would have qualified him as a genuine feminist, even though he would have been the first to deny that. It might also be interesting to you to know that when the Young Turks within the medical staff were stirring up political activity to highlight the needs of the mentally ill, John Cade tolerated all of their activism and advised that as long as they do not sacrifice the patients on the altar of ideology and that patient care was not compromised, they were quite at liberty, safe from his disapproval, to continue their political activities as much as they wished. Also, his sense of responsibility for patients' welfare in the trial of lithium was well demonstrated by his taking lithium carbonate for 2 weeks to test whether it was toxic or had unpleasant side effects. His wife, Jean, recalled that she looked at him the next day and the weeks that followed and wondered what she would do if he was changed by the lithium. Together with his love of the natural world was a boyish sense of humor with a particular penchant for limericks, malapropisms, and pithy yarns. A well-written book was always welcome, especially if it related to history. But his culture did not extend far into music. As he would say, this was not one of his long suits, and his tastes ran primarily to such pieces as the melodious but relatively unsubtle 1812 Overture and Capriccio Italian by Tchaikovsky. Let's enjoy a few minutes of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture together. To those closest to him, whether family, friends, or colleagues, he was best known professionally as a clinician, a teacher, and a humanitarian rather than a researcher. For treating patients, teaching both undergraduates and postgraduates, and caring for others were his life's work and intellectual curiosity, and its fruits were integral to these activities rather than a field in its own right. It was moving to hear him on the event to mark his retirement publicly thank his many patients for all they had taught him, and clearly this is what underpinned his professional life. He had spent the last 25 years of his professional life as the busy superintendent of the Royal Park Psychiatric Hospital, where he was also dean of the clinical school. But John Cade was not perfect. Although he was a kind, tolerant, and deeply Christian gentleman, he was an addicted and stubborn smoker despite his family's pleadings. Doubtless, this habit was irrevocably entrenched during wartime, and it was to be eventually fatal. During his last month, when he was dying from inoperable and metastatic carcinoma of the esophagus, he was always calm and dignified despite advanced cachexia, intractable nausea, and repeated hospitalization. Cachexia, or wasting syndrome, is a condition that causes significant weight loss and muscle loss. It often affects people with severe chronic diseases such as advanced cancer and heart disease. His request at the time was for the simplest box in which to be buried in the country at Yanyin near his parents, and for donations to the overseas missions instead of any flowers at his funeral. He died only 3 years after his retirement in November 16, 1980, at the age of 68. Alas, at an age when many more years of happy life might normally have been expected. In his family life, this man of great curiosity did puzzles and riddles, set problems for his children, and was constantly asking the question, why is it so? Such curiosity so pervaded John Cade's life that the process of his discovery of lithium as a treatment of manic excitement can readily be understood. Although he himself described the process as serendipity, such a serendipity was driven by insatiable curiosity and hunger for knowledge. A charming and unflappable man, John Cade taught us to be humble in our professional role, eschewing the hierarchy in our relationship with all who contribute to the welfare of our patients. He was an uncommon man with a very common touch. That's all I had to cover for you in this episode. I put the link to the references for this episode in the description. Also, please subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and follow our Instagram page. I post complimentary pics and content for each episode there. I'm sure you will enjoy watching them. Also, let me know which pharmaceutical drugs story you would like to hear in your podcast. Before saying goodbye, I'd like to take a moment and thank my advisor, Dr. Amit Pai, professor of clinical pharmacy at the University of Michigan, and my great friend and colleague, Dr. Levi Hooper, for their support in producing this episode. With that, stay tuned for the second episode very soon. We'll be in touch.